This is a special KMOX sports presentation.
KMOX congratulates Bob Costas on his induction into baseball's Hall of Fame. Presented by SSM Health, Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. Visit us at glennon.org. Now, your host, KMOX Sports Director, Tom Ackerman.
I'm Tom Ackerman at the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, and welcome back to KMOX. This hour, a special tribute to Bob Costas, the KMOX alum who receives the Ford C. Frick Award at the Baseball Hall of Fame for excellence in broadcasting this weekend. Throughout his career, a tremendous presence on NBC, on MLB Network Now, and in between many, many appearances throughout the years as a broadcaster, play-by-play, interviews, features, and one of the great voices of our industry. It all started here at KMOX Radio, and receiving the phone call from Cooperstown was very meaningful to Bob. He has a great heart for our city of St. Louis.
Well, I was so thrilled, and it really gave me goosebumps. I knew it was possible, but I could make a very strong case for everyone else who was on the ballot. And one thing I could say parenthetically, St. Louis is disproportionately represented. Just like St. Louis has a prominent place, maybe out of proportion to its size population-wise in the history of baseball, so too in baseball broadcasting. Jack Buck, Harry Carey, Joe Garagiola, someday soon Joe Buck. I'm sure it's only a matter of time till Joe Buck finds his way into the broadcaster's wing of the Baseball Hall of Fame. And I may be leaving some others out. So to be even a small part of that legacy St. Louis-wise, and then to join a fraternity that includes Mel Allen and Red Barber and Vin Scully and Ernie Harwell and on, I don't want to continue the list because I'll slight somebody, but these are all people I either listened to growing up, or if they're close to contemporaries, they're people I greatly respect and admire, people I've worked with, like Tim McCarver and Tony Kubek and Bob Uecker. And I owe a debt of gratitude to them as well. All of those circumstances, all of those people and places flashed through my mind when I got the call from Jeff Idelson, who's the president of the Hall of Fame.
Costas grew up in New York, born in Queens. He moved to Long Island, went to college at Syracuse. But throughout that time, St. Louis, even then, had a major presence in his life.
Like so many people, you grew up listening to Jack Buck and Harry Carey on the radio.
Well, as you know, I grew up in New York, but I heard Jack and Harry long before I ever came to St. Louis. I had this crazy thing that I did when I was 11, 12 years old, 1963, 64. I'd take the keys to my dad's car and go out in the driveway. This is, you know, before superstations and ESPN and CNN, and the only way you could follow an out-of-town game was to try to pick up the signal on the radio. And I'd turn the ignition key and start calibrating that radio dial like I was a safe cracker, and I'd pick up WBAL in Baltimore and hear Chuck Thompson and Bill O'Donnell, and I'd get KDKA in Pittsburgh and hear Bob Prince and WJR and Ernie Harwell. And all of a sudden, on an especially clear night from more than 1,000 miles away, sometimes as clear as a bell, here'd be Harry and Jack describing a pennant race game. And, you know, Harry's descriptions were so vivid and so exciting, it made you want to be right there in Sportsman's Park, because nothing anywhere in baseball could be that exciting.
You know, sometimes, Bob, I cringed when Harry was alongside, and I was doing play-by-play, and there was a big play, like a home run, or I remember when we clinched the pennant in Philadelphia in 67, Lou Brock bounced one off the scoreboard with the bases loaded, and I happened to be on the air at the time. I felt so bad, I really did. I felt so bad that Harry wasn't on doing the play-by-play because he enjoyed it so much, he enjoyed it more than I did.
Yeah, it really meant everything to him. And, you know, he had, and we say this kindly because, like you said a moment ago, he was a character in the best sense of the word. He also, to perform like that, had to have a large ego. And he felt that he was the voice of the Cardinals, and at that time he was, even as great as you were. And I guess he felt that on the most important moments, he ought to be the voice that was there for posterity.
Later in his life, he found himself working alongside Jack Buck at KMOX. Dan Dierdorf was at the station at the time.
Well, I started to work at the station in 75, the next year, on a part-time basis, obviously, because I was still a player with the football Cardinals. And, you know, just, I'm like everybody else. I heard Bob on the air before I met him, And then I met him, and you just realize what a fun guy this is to be around. And I look back at times where I was sitting in the sports office at Camo X, and I'm, honest to God, I'm sitting there, and I'm sitting there with Bob Costas, and I'm sitting there with Jack Buck, and Bill Wilkerson is there, and Dan Kelly comes walking in, and Gary Bender sticks his head in around the corner, and you're just, I was thinking to myself, I can't really be here. This really can't be happening. And over the years, I think St. Louisans just grew accustomed to hearing these voices on such a regular basis, and they didn't realize that it's not like this in every city in America, where there's this much talent packed into this small little space, the sports office at Camo X.
You know, you throw in Bob Starr, who was, Bob Starr was as good a radio football announcer as has ever lived, and yep. all of us marveled at the fact that he would call a game without a spotter and without the usual spotting board with all the information on it. He'd just take the flip card that they'd hand to anybody who walked into the press box that had the whole roster on it, and he'd sit there with the flip card in front of him and do a flawless call of any college or NFL football game. So you had him, and prior to that time, of course, Harry Carey had been with Jack Buck, and it wasn't too long after that before young Joe Buck came along. And I think we can say, not boastfully, but with real pride, that when we were all together, our staff was probably as good as most entire network sports staffs. We could have put our staff against CBS's staff, NBC's, ABC's, and we would have held our own.
The major influence on the Hall of Fame career of Bob Costas, but none of it happens without the decision made by Robert Hyland to hire him at KMOX. You'll hear Bob Costas, Mike Shannon, and Mike Claiborne discuss Bob Hyland in this tribute to Bob Costas. The Ford C. Frick Award at the Baseball Hall of Fame, sponsored by SSM Cardinal Glenn and Children's Hospital. Visit them at glennon.org. I'm Tom Ackerman in Cooperstown, back in a moment on America's Sports Voice, KMOX.
This is a special KMOX sports presentation. KMOX congratulates Bob Costas on his induction into baseball's Hall of Fame. Presented by SSM Health, Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. Visit us at glennon.org. Now, once again, KMOX Sports Director Tom Ackerman.
Welcome back to our tribute to Bob Costas, now a Hall of Famer, receiving the Ford C. Frick Award at the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. I'm Tom Ackerman in Cooperstown, and a look back at the career of Bob and how it all began at KMOX in the 1970s. Costas was hired by the general manager at KMOX. Let's turn things over to Mike Claiborne and Mike Shannon with Bob in the KMOX broadcast booth at Busch Stadium.
I'm going to throw a name out to both you guys, and I know people here in St. Louis may remember him, Bob Hyland. And yeah, I mean, we've all had if it wasn't for him, I'm not sure if any of us would be here doing this show tonight.
You know, it's one of these things, as so many things are, as the world changes, the technology changes, it's one of those you had to be there to really understand it deals. John Smoltz and I, a week ago, were talking about Fernando Valenzuela. And I said, it's not enough to say that he won his first 8 games and 5 of them were shutouts and that 40,000 people turned out at Shea Stadium to see him pitch, and the day before they drew 5,000 and the day after they drew 12. Because if you weren't alive at that time and old enough to appreciate it, you didn't understand that the game of the week on Saturday was different than just a random baseball game on television now. If you were a baseball fan in Montana, you didn't mow your lawn during those 3 hours when the Yankees played the Red Sox or Fernando faced Johnny Bench and the Reds. The world was a different place, and you couldn't automatically tap into every game Fernando pitched. So you'd find out about it the next morning in the newspaper, or you'd hear about it word of mouth, or if he came to your town, it would be the one chance you got to see him. When DiMaggio's hitting streak was underway, people would wake up and grab the morning. Did he get another hit? The world is so different now. So when you ask me about Bob Hyland, as powerful as KMOX is now, as prestigious as it is, in the 1960s, the 70s, the 80s, probably the 50s, KMOX was more important than any television station in town. The radio stars on KMOX were bigger stars than the news anchors in town. The New York Times of St. Louis was not, with all due respect, the Post-Dispatch, the Pulitzer family, the Pulitzer Prize, but still, the New York Times of St. Louis was KMOX. It was the authority. It was the central voice. It was truly the voice of St. Louis. And at a time when the Cardinals were the westernmost and southernmost franchise in all of baseball before expansion, you're on a station that could be heard in 30, 35 states on a given night, plus 200 different affiliates. It was just a whole different thing. Radio was so primary, and Bob Hyland ran it both lovingly and authoritatively. We loved him, and we quaked in fear every time we crossed his path. We didn't want to get on his bad side.
When that red phone would ring,
oh gosh,
you thought your career was...
How about when you walked into his office? Absolutely zero on his desk.
Zero.
Nothing on his
desk.
Not a piece
of paper.
Nothing. And he had his little... He recorded everything. He had a little recorder down there. He would record. But, you know, you talk about the magnitude of him as a radio station and so forth, so on, and truly so. But the impact that he had on our community.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, we miss him more than any other person that I can think of in this city as far... He was the one person that could keep the county and the city together.
When it came to getting things done, he might have been more powerful than most governmental officials.
No, no doubt about
his
it.
Radio station was tremendously influential. He had an unbelievable eye for talent. You know, he had a standard that his station would maintain. William S. Paley called KMOX the crown jewel of the CBS firmament.
Yep.
And in truth, of all the owned and operated stations then that CBS had, St. Louis was the smallest city among them. The others were in New York, Chicago, L.A., whatever it might be. But KMOX was by far the most significant and the most powerful of them. And Bob Hyland was, you know, like with anybody. We're talking about Muhammad Ali tonight. It's one thing to be excellent. It's another thing to have a dazzling or charismatic presence. Bob Hyland looked like central casting sent in a judge or a senator.
Blake Harrington.
Yeah. He looked like John Forsythe.
Yeah.
He did. And he was friends with John Forsythe. Because
was a
Forsythe,
really neat guy, Forsythe.
Oh, a tremendous guy. Tight with Mike Rorty and Anheuser-Busch. Oh, he was a great guy.
He loved horse racing. And he was the marshal in the Kentucky Derby for a number of years.
But Bob Hyland in a navy blue or gray suit... Every day, 6'2", strikingly handsome, deep voice, traditional, authoritarian. There was a warm heart within there, but boy, oh boy, did he mean business. And so you would never say to him, if he said to you, I need you at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning, and you said, Mr. Hyland, I'm doing a game in Los Angeles today for the network. Well, get on the red eye. It'll land at 6, and you'll be here at 7. And the reason you couldn't say no wasn't just because he was tough, but because he himself was at his own desk at 3 o'clock in the morning
every
day.
Earlier than that.
So how could you say, I'm too tired, or I don't feel like it? He never didn't feel like it.
Well, it's like hunting with Red Cheney's. I hunt with Red Cheney's now. How can I say that I'm cold or I'm tired? He's 93.
He's an amazing 93.
Phenomenal. You just think of the people that we've known over the years, and you mentioned Bob Hyland. Just start naming the people that he hired here and that have gone on. In sports, sure, we all know that. But how about the rest of the guys that worked over there?
Bob Hardy, Rex Davis, Jack Carney, Jim White. You know, he even hired for a few years Art Fleming, who was the original host of Jeopardy. Before Alex Trebek.
Some of the great things were with Red Rush, though.
Oh, Red Rush. You know, Red Rush was the voice of Loyola. Of Chicago basketball.
Mm-hmm. Twice.
They won the national championship.
63.
They beat Cincinnati, which had won a couple of titles. And if you can dig up Red's call of that overtime win by Loyola Chicago, it is a hoot.
He was a hoot. What do you got here?
I went to the. He had a friend out in Los Angeles that, for the racetrack, he was a he was an actuary for an insurance company, and this is when the computers first came out,
right?
And they were in 15 story buildings, filled up the whole. Okay, and he won the pick six about six or seven times. Okay, because he would take each race and run it 100,000 times through that computer. Okay, and. And he would bet.
It was out. A lot of free time.
You know, yeah. But, well, he would do that because the computer worked all night, you know, and they didn't, so he, back then. But anyway, he would bet. He would bet, okay, he'd be $60 on this horse to win and $42 on him to place. It was all figured out mathematically. But Red Rush was hired, okay, and Highland wanted to fire him halfway through the season, and the brewery wouldn't let him. And so he... There was a couple of sayings that Red had that he despised. I can't remember some John. He just highly despised him, you know. And so finally after, he said to him, "Don't use that anymore." And so the next day, Red had gone, and he'd use it just because he knew Highland was sitting over there cringing.
You know,
he knew it was gone.
Again, we're losing maybe everyone who's 25 years old who started out listening to this. You gotta understand the time and the frame of reference. But Mr. Highland was so almost comically authoritarian, but his presence was so arresting, and his success was so obvious that whatever he said, that was the law. And one time, I'm 24, 25 years old, and a broadcaster who shall go unnamed was filling the hours in between one sports event and another, kind of a fallow period, like on a Saturday late afternoon. So none of the big stars were available. And this was a guy that Highland didn't have much use for. So the phone rings in the sports office. I answer the phone. He says, "Bob?" I say, "Yes, Mr. Highland." He goes, "Get that idiot off the air." Well, what am I supposed to do? Go yank him out of his seat? "Well, Mr. Highland, what do you want?" "He's an idiot." And I'm thinking, well, you hired him.
Right, he's your guy.
All right. Go in there, and you go on with him, but don't let him talk. Radio, for God's sake. Don't let... Okay, I got it. No,
I'll just cut
no
his
problem.
Microphone off.
No problem. So he would get a certain notion in his head. There was a guy who used to do a show on Saturday nights from the top of a Holiday Inn named Otis Boogeyman Thomas.
Thomas.
You remember this guy?
Oh, yeah, I remember.
He's a nice guy.
Yeah.
Otis Boogeyman Thomas. This is when the disco era was at its peak, mm-hmm. or depending on your taste, its nadir, yeah. sometime in the 70s, right? So he had this show called The Boogie Machine,
mm-hmm.
and he would come on, all right, and he'd have these women in spandex, these tight spandex outfits, and they'd kind of be his dancers, and he had the theme, Boogie Machine, Boogie Machine, Boogie Machine. And then out would come the boogeyman, okay? So Mr. Highland is reading the trades at his desk one Saturday morning, and he sees that disco is the big deal. So he thinks he's going to be on the cutting edge. He's got nothing on Saturdays if we don't have a ball game, if there's a night game. So he hires Otis Thomas. He calls me in because I'm the youngest person there. He says, "What do you know about this boogeyman?" So I give him the scouting report. He goes, "Is disco a big thing?" I go, "I don't like it very much, Mr. Island, but yeah, it's a big thing." So he hires him, all right? So now Otis is on the air for two or three weeks, and there's no email or Twitter. It's actual mail, all right? So the mail takes a while to come in. So now it's the next Saturday afternoon, and I got to get in my car and come. I need to see you right away. So I drive downtown, and I get out at 1 Memorial Drive, and I walk into his office, and like you say, there's his desk. It's completely pristine. It's polished to a high gloss. He had all those glass figurines yep. up on the crystal figures, and he's sitting there, immaculate as can be, and he's got all these letters that he then takes out of a folder, and he says, "Bob, is there a song called I Want to Kiss You All Over?" So, well, Mr. Highland, there probably is. He says, "Well, according to this lady in Afton, the boogeyman played that song." So on, he probably did. And then he slammed his fist down, holding the letter in his left hand. He slams his fist down on the desk and he goes, "The boogeyman has gone too far."
If you had videos of these things, you could tell them.
I said, well, Mr. Hyland, it wasn't my idea to hire him.
I tried to warn you.
Our thanks to Bob Hyland for making it happen. Robert Hyland hired Bob Costas here at KMOX. I'm Tom Ackerman. Our special looking at the career of Bob Costas, the Ford C. Frick Award recipient for excellence in broadcasting at the Baseball Hall of Fame this weekend. I'm here in Cooperstown, and when we come back, as Bob raised his family in St. Louis, he had a son. Keith Costas is our guest next. This sponsored by SSM Health, Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. Visit them at glennon.org on America's Sports Voice, KMOX.
This is a special KMOX sports presentation.
KMOX congratulates Bob Costas on his induction into baseball's Hall of Fame. Presented by SSM Health, Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. Visit us at glennon.org. Now, once again, KMOX Sports Director Tom Ackerman.
Welcome back to Cooperstown, and Bob Costas is going into the Baseball Hall of Fame, receiving the Ford C. Frick Award, and what a pleasure to be joined by his son, Keith, who at one time was an intern in our KMOX sports office. He has done terrific work, a two-time Sports Emmy winner himself, by the way, as a producer with MLB Network. Keith, I know how proud you must be of your father going into the Hall of Fame and receiving this prestigious award.
Yeah, absolutely. I was up here for the first time when I was 7 years old with my dad in 1993, a very memorable trip, one of my great baseball memories with my dad. But I have a feeling that this weekend might move it down the list to number two.
That's right. Tell me about that trip. I was there also in 1993 with my dad for the first time. What was that trip like for you?
Yeah, we tried to pick out a time when it wasn't too crowded. And as you know, Cooperstown can be kind of a sleepy little town when there's not a big event going on. So there weren't many crowds, and we got to kind of take in the town and the hall over a couple days without much commotion around us. And it was just kind of what you'd expect, kind of a classic father-son bonding over baseball type of thing. And him, I was young enough that everything was pretty new in the hall to me. So it was kind of a crash course in baseball history, but also just your standard father-son hanging out time. So a really memorable trip, and Cooperstown's always fun, but that's one that sticks in my mind for sure.
No question. In fact, you have baseball from the very beginning in that Bob one time promised Kirby Puckett, isn't that right, that if he was batting over 350, I think it was, by the time you were born, that he would name the baby Kirby.
That's exactly right. I don't think he'd ever hit 300 at that point. He was pretty early in his career, and he knew that Kirby knew that my dad and mom were expecting a baby, and he asked, do you have a name picked out yet? And my dad said no, and he said, boy or girl? And they said, no, we're not going to find that out either. And he said, well, how about Kirby? Works for a boy, works for a girl. They kind of laughed it off, and as the season went on, it was early in the season, April, but the Twins were pretty good, so my dad saw him a couple times on the game of the week, and he kind of prod him and remind him, hey, how about Kirby? And eventually they came up with a little wager, 350 or better, and we'll name him Kirby. And I think he was at 375 on the due date and up to 389 when I finally showed up. So original birth certificate, Keith Michael Costas. The mom was not quite as into the batting average dictating lifelong names as the father was, surprisingly. And then Kirby, showed up, I guess, with some kind of signed document and said, whoa, we've got a deal here. So a few weeks later, it was back to the drawing board, and Keith Michael Kirby Costas was the new birth certificate.
Wow, that's fantastic. Keith Costas is with us as we honor his father, the KMOX alum, Bob Costas, receiving the Ford C. Frick Award here in Cooperstown. I want to play you this. We had your dad on the air recently, and this is what he said about not only himself and some people before him, but other KMOXers are certain to go in. Take a listen.
I guess Joe Buck is going to have his turn. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that there will come a time soon enough when Joe Buck is in Cooperstown and he will comprise with his dad the first ever father-son combination in the broadcaster's wing. And I think his experience will be somewhat similar to Keith's. Keith did not become a broadcaster, he became a producer. But like Joe Buck, he was around the game and all the things that I broadcast from a very young age. I remember meeting Joe Buck when he was 7. And when Keith was 5, 6, 7 years old, he was on the road with me when school let out at the NBA Finals or on weekends at the World Series or baseball playoff games. And heaven knows how many Cardinal games we went to each summer, probably 30, 35 games just to hang around. You know, and he was, although he was always polite, Mr. Torrey, Mr. La Russa, Mr. Herzog, he was kind of on a first-name basis with all those guys when he was just a toddler.
What was that like, Keith? What do you remember about those times?
Yeah, well, when I think about this weekend from my dad's perspective first, I always go back to a conversation we had when I was probably 15 or 16, and he was explaining to me what it was like, you know, when he first started doing the game of the week, and he was a young guy and not really known outside of St. Louis or maybe Syracuse where he went to school, and he was partnered with Tony Kubek, who, you know, that would be like someone from St. Louis partnering with Ozzie Smith. He grew up watching those great Yankee teams where Tony was the shortstop, and all of a sudden, 10, 15 years later, he's working with him, and he talked about how Tony really vouched for him with the scouts and the managers and the players and everybody around the game, that, you know, he could trust him and that he could be part of the game, and how much that meant to him just to kind of be a part of the game was such a big thing for him. And being lucky enough to grow up around it, I got a little taste of that, like he talked about in that clip, just being around the game, just being part of it day to day. And that's something that stuck with me. I knew, you know, like he mentioned, I didn't become a broadcaster like Joe. That wasn't the path I wanted to choose. But being a part of the game and being a part of that world was always something that, on the one hand, seemed natural to me because I was lucky enough to grow up around it. But in another sense, seemed like something to strive towards. It just seemed like something I wanted to be a part of. And I know you can relate to that, too.
Sure. What's it like now, decades later, working with him?
You know, it's great because we've got, just from a practical sense, we have a little bit of space. It's not like we're working together day by day. It's not like he's in the cubicle right next to me Monday through Friday. But we do get to work together a lot on the road doing games, him calling the games and me in the truck. And, you know, that leads to a lot of time outside of work, too, a lot of fun dinners on the road and bonding time. And also getting to work together and collaborate together is a lot of fun, too.
Keith, finally, when you look at your dad's body of work through the years, not only in sports but also in entertainment and in news, how would you sum up what he's meant to the industry?
Wow. You know, I would just say integrity, a dedication to the craft, and being true to yourself, you know, not being afraid to say what needs to be said, and respecting the craft and taking every game seriously and striving for your best every game. You know, I get to work with him now, and I know that he takes, you know, Red Sox, Twins in April just as serious as he would a playoff game or a World Series game. And just understanding the responsibility of bringing these games to people and what it means to people and how being at your best, it might not be life and death, but you can help enhance people's entertainment and enjoyment, even if it's only for 3 hours a day, how much that can mean to people and what a privilege it is to help bring that to people.
It's great to talk to you. Very well said, by the way. It's great to talk to you as always. Really enjoy your work at MLB Network, and all the best to your dad. It's great to be here with you guys in Cooperstown, and we can't thank you enough for joining us on KMOX.
Thank you, Tom, and thank you to everyone at KMOX in St. Louis. It's such an important part of my dad's life and our lives and his journey here to the Hall of Fame.
Best to you, man. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tom.
There's Keith Costas. I'm Tom Ackerman. We'll be back in just a moment. Our coverage of Bob Costas in the Hall of Fame, sponsored by SSM Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. Visit them at glennon.org on the home of the best Cardinals coverage, KMOX.
This is a special KMOX sports presentation.
KMOX congratulates Bob Costas on his induction into baseball's Hall of Fame. Presented by SSM Health, Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. Visit us at glennon.org. Now, once again, KMOX Sports Director Tom Ackerman.
Welcome back to Cooperstown. I'm Tom Ackerman. Bob Costas could be inducted in multiple Halls of Fame. In fact, he is. But this one, the Ford C. Frick Award at the Baseball Hall of Fame, is as meaningful as anything he's ever received in his career. His love for the sport is evident. Mike Claiborne visited with him about the current state of the game.
This is your bailiwick. This is something you have a great passion for. Attendance is down. There doesn't appear to be enough good teams that people can support. The games run forever. How are we going to fix this before another sport moves to the front of the class as being perhaps a pastime?
Well, I think football is already, in every measurable way, the most popular sport.
But they're having
in
their
America.
Problems too, though.
Oh, yeah, they're having their problems.
Yeah.
And in addition to the issues, like the anthem issue, and they had a domestic violence issue, which can still rear its ugly head again. It seemed to be more acute a few years ago. There were more cases of it, but that doesn't mean it's gone away as an issue. And you have franchise relocations and other issues surrounding
football.
About
the quality of the game. I don't know if the quality of the game is as good as it needs to be.
It may not be, but what football does have as an issue existentially, mm-hmm. a fundamental issue, is the very nature of the game. I've said this before. You could play hockey without fights. You can play baseball without steroids. You could, you probably won't live to see it, but you could align academics and athletics in a way that it wouldn't be the sham that it is in so many places. But you cannot play football. At least we can't imagine how, and no technology and no approach has emerged that even comes close to creating a circumstance where you can play football without significant numbers of its participants suffering brain trauma. That's a fact. That's not an opinion. It's an established fact, and that's a big problem for football. But your initial question was about baseball. I think part of the reason attendance is down this year is that there was an uncommon run of really bad early season weather in a lot of places. But also, like you said, a lot of teams are following the model that worked for a while for Kansas City and is continuing to work for the Cubs and the Astros, which is we'll be lousy for a while in order keep the payroll down, not spend on middling level players so that we can be five games under 500 every year. We'll get the draft picks. We'll conserve our resources. And then when it's time, when those draft picks have come to fruition, we might go get a Justin Verlander when we're on the verge, like the Astros did. A lot of teams are trying to emulate that model, and for the time being, they stink. And when you consider what you said about how long games take, it's one thing if you're watching the game on TV, you're in your own house, you get up, you walk around. But if you're at the ballpark, and not only does the game take 3.5 or 4 hours, but you schlep to the park, you park your car, and you know it isn't cheap to go to games anymore. You take your wife and kids, and you could spend several hundred dollars at the ballpark. And although baseball's revenues are significantly greater than they were a decade ago, we might be seeing a little bit of a reaction to all those factors.
Throw in the fact that fans have other options. I think that has a lot to do with it. And I think fans are smarter with regard to what they're watching. And right. You can't give the company line and expect everybody to buy into it anymore. But the game itself, the on-field product, is a concern also, where the games, as we mentioned, they take forever. Strikeouts are at an all-time high. Everybody wants to hit the home run. I see teams that can't even hit a cutoff man. I see teams that are frightening in the field defensively. And the fundamentals have just seemed to have been abolished, more or less. So how do you fix that part of the game?
Well, that's an organizational thing. You have organizations like the Cardinals and like the Dodgers that teach the game the right way. When players are called up from Memphis, they're big league ready. So I think that's the general answer to that. But the bigger problem is everybody likes home runs, yeah. But when there are more strikeouts than there are base hits, and right now we're on pace to have more strikeouts this year in baseball than base hits, the endangered species in baseball is the single.
Yeah.
The most common of base hits actually is hard to come by these days. And you see fewer and fewer rallies, you know, where you string together five base hits, a stolen base, a walk, a sacrifice. That's a rally.
Yeah.
A rally is not a walk and a home run. That does produce two runs, and it has its place. But a rally is something that you see less and less often these days. And the ball is in play less often than it has ever been. Now, people may not be excited by a pop-up or a routine ground ball to shortstop, but some balls in play are a line drive into the gap, and the right fielder cuts it off, and the guy has to decide in a split second, do I try to stretch this into a double? That's the kind of thing that's exciting to watch, and you're not seeing as much of it as you used to.
I was talking to Bob Nightingale recently, and he said that there were over 40 guys in the lineup on one particular night in Major League Baseball that were hitting under 200.
And yet, since batting average has been devalued, if their OPS is acceptable, if they draw some walks and they hit some home runs, they have a spot on a big league roster.
Where do you stand on analytics and how it is now? It doesn't have a fingerprint. It has a foothold in the game. And I think we see sometimes where we're trying to find the middle ground between the analytics and the actual physical play that really kind of gives us the model player we're looking for.
Well, I think analytics has an important place. And it's been shown when you look at Theo Epstein with the Cubs and Jeff Luhnow, late of the Cardinals, now of the Astros. It works. It worked for Billy Beane with limited resources for a long time in Oakland.
But did it really work? Because I always felt...
They lost in the postseason, but yeah, it worked in the regular season.
But Moneyball, and everybody talked about, well, this is the future with the A's. You know, the only trophy they won was the Academy Award. I mean, they really didn't... They became a farm system more than anything else for somebody else. But I'm not sure if that concept really has worked in the manner that I think we expected it to.
Part of the problem for them was they could not hang on to the players who they had discovered, the diamonds in the rough they had discovered. Once those players became arbitration or free agent eligible, they couldn't hang on to them because at that point baseball's economics had not been reformed and there wasn't as much shared revenue at that time as there is now. And of course it was convenient for the purposes of the book and the movie to overlook Hudson and Zito and who was the third?
Mark Mulder.
Yeah. Those guys were not Moneyball finds.
No,
they were from the farm system. But the idea that getting on base, that on base percentage is more important than batting average, I think is legitimate. And I don't want people to think that I'm a traditionalist on this. I was one of the first people that ever put Bill James on the radio on KMOX. I subscribed to Bill James' baseball abstract when he was mimeographing it out of his house in Kansas. So I think that analytics has its place. But I've had this conversation with many baseball people, and they nod their heads vigorously in agreement, especially the managers do. Look, analytics is made up of the macro, but each baseball moment is a micro. So it may totally be true that after 100 pitches, Joe Jones is ineffective, or he's ineffective the third time through the lineup. That's what the analytics tell us in general. But on this particular night, the keen eye of the longtime baseball man may be able to pick up that he hasn't had that many high-stress innings, that he's still throwing free and easy, that we had to use our bullpen heavily the last couple of nights and we'd rather not dip into it any earlier than we need to. So we're going to send him out there for the seventh inning, no matter if it makes the analytics guy's head explode. You know, I think that the baseball guy has to be aware of the analytics, but he also has to have a feel for that game and that moment that night.
I wonder if there are enough people who still have a feel, because I think we're going in that direction where a lot of people don't have the feel, hence they make the decisions strictly by what the new book publishes.
Well, there's some of that, but I think, like you, that there ought to be a place for a blending of an intelligent retention of old school outlooks with all of the new information, which is valuable. And from a broadcasting standpoint, I'll just say this. If Aaron Judge hits a ball 500 feet, I want to know the launch angle and the exit velocity. But I don't need to know that 15 times a game. And I don't need a strike zone box to show me whether a slider that made the count 1-1 actually did or didn't get the outside corner. How is it that Jack Buck and Harry Carey and Ernie Harwell and Vin Scully were so great, and Red Barber and Mel Allen, so great for so long without any of that? Why? Because they were enjoyable to listen to and they knew how to tell a story. And I think that when you watch these games now, even with broadcasters who you like, it's like they're conducting an autopsy on every pitch. And we have to have a breakdown of every pitch sequence. Everything is mechanics. Everything is analytics. How about a story
How about an anecdote? How about something funny? How about some sense of what it feels like in the ballpark, or how the weather is, or something of interest that can't be broken down clinically, but it's human.
The game of baseball is very fortunate that Bob Costas remains a part of it and will be for a long time. He continues to call games on MLB Network. Now a Hall of Famer, the recipient of the Ford C. Frick Award here in Cooperstown. I'm Tom Ackerman. Thanks to our sponsor, SSM Health, Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. Visit them at glennon.org on America's Sports Voice, KMOX.